welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Last week we had on new council member Seth Walsh, and this week's guest is new Chief Teresa Vici.
It's new time,
it
right?
It is new time. You know what? The city does seem like it's getting like this really fresh reset. I can't wait to cover it.
Well, I know you can't wait to cover it, but we should talk about something we haven't talked about, at least for a week or so, and that's this railroad sale.
Oh, I've been writing about it.
It's time to talk about it again because we have a little bit of news, right?
You know what? I think we've seen like a lot of things like in this last week that happened. You know what? I gotta hand it to State Senator Bill Blessing. He, you know, this, it seems set. It's just a minor state law change that has to happen before the sale. It actually doesn't even seem like that big of a deal. But it seemed like it was set to sail through the lame duck session, which, by the way, was like 24 hours, of the state legislature. And State Senator Bill Blessing, who represents really a lot of the West Side and everything, is like, I have some questions. And he really asked that this be held until next year when there can be some hearings. And, you know, and Bill Blessing isn't even like, I'm against this. He's a Republican. Of course, every city's Democrat and everything. He wasn't like that. He's like, I just have questions. As the representative, I think it's okay to get the answers to the questions before we make a decision that allows for such a momentous thing to happen to the city that I represent in my district. And so anyway, that actually, it did get the delay, and it got a big delay. Now, it's certainly on track, you know, still to go to voters in here before we know it, November of 2023 in the general election. But, you know, there's going to still be some vetting ahead of time. The idea now is to put the law change in the transportation bill, which will kind of be settled all up in March. It got a little delay this last time in April. But anyway, around then, it doesn't go into effect until July 1st. And so that actually really gives it some time to have some extra critical looks, which I'm here for. The city did give me a trove of public documents about the negotiations. Now, why they didn't just show this from the get-go, I don't know.
I think the hope was, and you probably know more than me because I haven't really talked with anyone about this, but anytime you have this big press conference, you're hoping that it'll just sail through, that you kind of create this narrative that it's a no-brainer. Like, why would we, you know, limit our revenue from the railroad to this lease payment when we could sell it and maybe double the money through the interest that the trust fund will kick out? But like Blessing and a few other senators, you know, in the waning hours of the lame duck session, they didn't get that vote. That doesn't mean it's dead. I mean, when the legislature comes back, they can tee it up again. But one of the big questions is, what's a railway really worth? Are they cutting themselves short by settling for, where did they come up with $1.6 billion?
That question remains. So the valuations still are outstanding, like all of the valuations. But Paul Muthing, the rail board president, did tell me last week that they had a valuation kind of at the beginning of the negotiations when they're really just going to be like, this is a lease and we're going to re-enter into a lease. And that valuation was $1.5 billion. And they set a lease price that they requested from Norfolk Southern based on that $1.5 billion, which was $65 million a year, which is like way more than 25,
right,
26 than they had been getting, but it was very aggressive. And if they had just answered these questions from the get-go, I think it would have been very helpful to their cause. Now, I'm not going to say if I think the deal is good or bad, but please go back and look at my story that posted earlier this week, because it's all the documents. The rail board drove the hardest deal. I was like, who is this rail board? Because you can read the back and forth of what's happening in all of the, you know, month by month and everything. Then don't get me started on executive sessions. That's a different story, right? But you see the conversations between the two, and Norfolk Southern is lowballing the city like nobody's business. And they're just like, oh, you know, when I think it was like $915 million, and the city's like, no way. At one point, one of the letters is like, grossly inadequate. No, let's go. And they're like, and we're going to move on, and this is the lease. And you could tell that Norfolk Southern, they're either tired of dealing with it, or they know, because over a year and a half, the number creeps up and creeps up and creeps up. And it finally, and the city at one point is like, you know what? Do you want a deal? Great then, $2 billion. And I think they were like, whoa. And then it ends up with this $1.6 billion. But the rail board drove what to me does really look like a hard bargain in getting this done. And there's been a lot of explanation, but I literally don't understand why it didn't come on day one.
Well, and one of the issues that was raised in a very detailed, very wonky...
I read every word.
...opinion piece by Kevin Flynn, the former city council member, who also happens to teach and has taught for years in UC's College of Law, all things real estate, digs into what is the fair market value of a railroad, not just to sell it, but to lease it. And the current lease, which, you know, part of the argument from the city and the railroad trustees board is that by selling it, creating the trust fund, they'll get more revenue than they are currently leasing the railroad. Well, why not renegotiate the lease to fair market value? That's Kevin Flynn's, you know, the basis of his op-ed is that there are other options besides selling it, not the least of which is, can you renegotiate what that lease payment is, because it's not anywhere near close, according to him, and he's got a lot of detail in there to back up his opinion, that, what is it, $24 million, the current lease payment?
It's like $25 million.
Something like that is about half of what they might get if you factor in what fair market value is. And again, slowing this down, I don't want to say, let this thing run out of steam, but slow it down a little bit and let people do some due diligence on what the best option is. And I thought this was interesting. He, in his op-ed, reminded everybody about how when the city was trying to sell the its parking operations.
Who could ever forget that?
Who could ever forget that? It was Mayor John Cranley who said, and I think he might have been a city council member at that time, who said, no. Why would
incoming mayor.
Incoming mayor. Why would you unnecessarily sell off an asset? You know, you have an asset. Why sell it off for a short-term game when it should be part of your long-term play? And he says that, you know, that was great advice then, and it's good advice now. So, and, you know, John's a Democrat. So this isn't just a, you know, D versus R, city versus county versus state kind of squabble. This is really, I think... You know, and I don't have an opinion on it personally, but a lot of people feel that this almost like hurried, panicked effort to get this deal pushed through at least needs to be slowed down so people can determine things like what is the value of the railway and, you know, what are other ways to make that asset pay as opposed to selling it. So... And does anyone else want it? Why are we only, you know, dealing with one potential?
Well, the lease does give, unfortunately, the lease does give Norfolk Southern really the exclusivity rights to do the
right, a first refusal.
Well, they want it.
Right. but nowhere in the lease says that if there's a higher bidder that they have to go with Norfolk Southern. They just have
it does say that, though.
I thought it's right of first refusal.
It is not.
Well, that's a terrible lease.
It's basically like an extension.
Who signed that lease?
That's actually a really good question.
That'd be a good question. Who signed the original lease?
Oh, look at you guys. Right before
Christmas. More work for Sherry to do.
To be fair, my railroad story list has about 100 things on it. So what's 101? Let's go.
Yep. All right. Well, we could talk more about the railroad.
Well, we will because we have a whole year ahead of the vote.
But I think now we should talk to the first woman to hold the job.
I know,
police
historic.
Chief
it's historic.
In the city of Cincinnati. Let's do that now.
special guest time on That's So Cincinnati. It's been quite a week for our guest, Chief Theege. Welcome, Chief.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Are you used to people calling you Chief, or has everyone just been calling you Chief because it's hard to say interim chief?
Yeah, so when I first became interim, it was a little hard to get used to, a little unusual. But yeah, that's been the simplest thing to call me during the whole interim time. So now it doesn't feel any different.
So what was it like when the city manager called you? Did she tell you in person? I'm just guessing she called.
She told me in person. So I was actually driving. I was out on Eastern Avenue, and I got a phone call from the city solicitor who said, can you come meet with me and the city manager in the city manager's office? And I said, sure, give me about 10 minutes and I'll be there. And, you know, when you get that call, because you know the solicitor is going to be involved in this conversation. So when you get that call, it's like, oh, I crossed my fingers. I said, I hope this is it.
The tip off was the city solicitor.
Correct.
Because she had to negotiate a contract.
Yeah, she had to, be a part of this. And I love working with her as well, Miss Emily Warner. So, I was excited to get the call. And then, I'm sitting in the chair outside the manager's door for just a moment. And your heart's beating. And then I get to go in and see him. It was exciting.
Did you turn on your lights and sirens to get all the way downtown?
No, not for this. I didn't.
Okay. So that's kind of, I get that's a natural question, how exciting it is. What did you think when you were leaving City Hall? You're by yourself and like, it's all kind of sinking in. And this is a job you've worked for your whole career. What was that first alone moment like?
Yeah, so it was very, very surreal. You get very excited about it. And then you also get this sense of, oh, Lord.
What have I done?
What have I done? And boy, I hope I can represent the city well.
Well, I'm sure the latter is going to be true, and I suspect Burl understands how you feel because he agreed to be editor of his hometown newspaper at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for is my advice to you. But you've been the interim chief, so this isn't walking into a situation cold. You have your supporting cast. What might be different day one between, because in the interim role, of course, you have to manage around the possibility that you might be replaced. It's difficult to make, big lasting decisions, but I'm sure you started putting a list together if this day were to happen.
Right. So first and foremost are some personnel needs that have to be addressed. And by that, I mean, we had a Captain Doug Wiseman who retired the end of November. He was the CBS commander. That is a critical role in our agency. And so I needed to fill that. So that some captains got moved around a little bit. And then obviously with that, sometimes there's lieutenants movements and things like that. Some of the natural things people expect when the new chief comes in, especially when there's vacancies that need to be filled. And so I took care of those pretty quickly. And then, the biggest thing for me is, I heard during this process, this whole selection process, that the city manager did a great job with engaging with everybody, even the officers on the department. And one of the things I heard was some of them say there is a morale issue and I have to go with that. And so now it's time to get to work, to drill down and see, okay, what in their eyes, what is causing the morale issue and how can I address that? And so that's going to be one of the first things we embark on.
I wrote a story. I asked for there was surveys done and they released publicly the community one, but I knew the officers had taken one and I asked for it. And honestly, when I read it, I was so stunned because, you just kind of fill it out perfunctory. You answer the questions. But so many officers took time to write in the comment section about the low morale. I mean, even you always hear low morale, and it's a tough time now for policing for sure. So some of that is certainly not surprising, but I was like, exclamation points, all capital letters, like so many took time to be like, here's the blank spot, tell me what you think. And they did it. And I was like, wow.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm speculating a little here until I do a more of a deeper dive into this, but I believe the, a lot of the morale issue has to do with shortage of personnel. And, you know, to this point from our recruiting efforts, I've done everything I can to try to boost it in that area. So now it's time to kind of move on to a secondary phase to try to get some officers back in patrol. And by that, I mean sitting down and, you know, identifying where every single person on this department is assigned and see if there's an opportunity to reallocate some of those resources back to patrol. So that will be one of the very first things I embark on.
So you've been in the department a long time. You see, I don't want to age you or anything, but you've seen some different chiefs, right? It is very hard to make decisions, right? When things, you know, when things have been kind of generous, we've reported on this. This isn't a secret. There's a lot of special units right now, and there could be more officers on the street. And certainly we're hearing that from the patrol officers themselves. How difficult is the balance, like going into this, like, of course you want to be liked and you're brand new, but you might have to be making, do you consider these hard decisions?
Yeah. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm not going to make these decisions on my own in a vacuum. I'm going to engage with the entire command staff. So, you know, we have 15 captains, myself, and then Colonel Davis and Colonel John. We are all going to hammer this out together. And then when we get to a point, we will bring up some sergeants, lieutenants, and officers in the department too, and let them weigh in on some of these decisions, because they're the ones that have to live with it day in and day out while they're doing their duties here. So I'm definitely not going to make this in a vacuum. I want to see, some people may have better ideas or things that I've never thought of, and I need to consider those. So we'll see where it takes us. I hope it's an exercise that pays dividends for us, and that everybody walks away going, okay, that was an appropriate decision to make.
So other than staffing and morale, which are kind of internal department challenges, where do you think your attention will be in your first year as chief as far as the job of policing Cincinnati?
Sure. So, you know, when I became interim, there were three things that I really wanted to focus on. And I feel like I've done that. That was reducing gun violence. You know, we're about to end our 2022 calendar year, and we're doing well. We could always do better, but we're doing well in that area. So we will continue that into 2023, because that is just hugely important to the city to reduce gun violence. The second thing was, I had said that we were going to work on recruiting and retention, and we worked with our background and recruiting unit and did a lot of work in that arena as well. We got the recruit pay increase, the hourly rate. We got some bonuses, some signing bonuses, some bonuses if you have prior law enforcement experience. But again, we still have to continue to try to move the needle in that. And then lastly, I had said I wanted to work on officer wellness. And if there's one thing that I'm just so proud of, is where this department has taken the topic of officer wellness. We started with just kind of an idea several years ago, and now we have an officer wellness unit. And while that unit is just one individual right now, we've seen a demand that we could use a second person there. So we're looking for some grant funding to be able to pay for a second person in the wellness unit. But above and beyond that, what really makes me happy about what we've done here is we've had a couple of officers who have stepped up to the wellness unit and said, I need help. And the wellness unit did what they are supposed to do. And now these officers have come back to me and said, I want to be a poster child for this. I want to talk to our cops about how the wellness unit and what the department did for me made me better, made my life better. And I think that is just extremely telling, that you have especially police officers who have asked for help, which used to be, you know, just a huge stigma associated with that. that now they're saying, I want to tell my story.
Which is helpful because
three things that you know, I started at the interim to focus on, and I'm going to continue to keep focusing on those three things. You know, the one other thing that we've not just talked a lot about, I need to dive back into the collaborative agreement refresh and some of the things that came out of that. One of the things we learned through that process was we were doing problem solving, but we really started slacking on our documentation of it. And so, you know, if it's not written down, it didn't happen. And so we've done better in that, but there's probably other areas from the refresh that we can turn our attention to now as well.
So I want to go back to that, but you had mentioned first tackling the gun violence problem. Last mm-hmm. week we had a story that was a follow-up really to our kids and guns story we did at the end of 2020. And it looked at the story last week, looked at some of these cases, two in particular, to just understand a little better and put some faces on this. And I think the challenge, one of the challenges when you talk about gun violence is that you have kids 12, 14, 15, 16 years old now that are resolving conflicts, whether they're full-blown gangs like we think of it traditionally or whether they're just groups of kids with beefs against each other. What 5-10 years ago would have been settled with fists or maybe a piece of pipe is being settled with guns. Do you have anything specifically focused on teenage gun violence?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, these are things that take a lot of time to figure out and to strategize about and then to implement. So we've been working with the city manager's office for a while now on gun violence, especially involving our youth. And so we'll continue to work with them to come up with some programming and like a whole umbrella approach to wrapping our arms around why are youth engaging in gun violence. You know, we see that they don't realize, first and foremost, they don't realize the consequences of their action. I don't think they are able to grasp that at such a young age. You know, they don't realize you pull that trigger, you are changing your life forever. You are changing the person who you shot. You're changing their life forever. And so I don't think they understand that. The other thing is something that was kind of new to me when people first started talking about it in this format was a lot of these kids, they are suffering from some type of traumatic events in their life and probably don't even realize it. So maybe it's their upbringing. Maybe it's their, they've had something in their life that was a traumatic experience for them. Maybe they saw violence firsthand. Maybe they've been a victim of violence, whatever it is that is causing them to act like this. And so I think we have to get really down in the weeds on that for this to make an impact in this area. That being said, we have to talk to the youth. We have to talk to them and find out what is going on and how can we help. And, you know, we're police officers. You know, we enforce the law. We go out. We help where we can. But we're not that level of social service type individuals. We're not the experts in this field. So we have to engage with some psychological services, people who are experts in youth psychological events that they may be dealing with. And it's going to be a solution is going to be way more than just the police, way more than the police. But we'll keep hammering away at that one as well, because that is really significant.
And I think that's an important point that there's only so much the police department can do. I mean, you're talking about generational poverty and you're talking about, you know, social issues that a lot of U.S. cities face right now. I know the pandemic is often cited as something that either exacerbated the situation or revealed it for us to see more clearly during that time. but we're actually going to continue to do our part too, just trying to tell the story, trying to focus on solutions. And I'm sure that between now and then, reporters will be asking you lots of questions about that. So,
yeah. Yeah, we do a lot of engagement from our youth services unit with the youth in the city of Cincinnati and all different levels. And that is a tremendous impact to have officers working hand in hand with the youth. And so hopefully it creates some dialogue, some interactions where the youth can really understand that resorting to gun violence is not the answer.
Are you eager to get started, or do you feel like you're already started?
You know, it's when I became interim, I remember telling the city manager, well, I feel like I get to test drive it before I decide if I want to buy it. And so I think this 10 months has really put me in a good place that I'm not as nervous about taking it on permanently, because I have had the opportunity to do it for 10 months. But I look forward to what I can do as a chief that maybe I didn't embark on as an interim. Because there's always that, well, I'm the interim. I'm not the chief. I'm the interim. Even though many, many people that I respect and look up to right away said, take the interim off the title. You're the chief. Everything falls on your shoulders, but you still have every once in a while a little hesitancy, because you're like, well, should I do this? What if I don't get the job? How long am I going to be here then? So now I can take it a little different approach to some things.
So one of the things that's, I won't say it's unique, but when you have turnover with the police chief, you have, you know, someone coming in that maybe wasn't the pick of the city manager, but we have a new city manager. That person hired you, Cheryl Long. And so it's almost like a fresh start when it comes to the relationship that a city manager has with the police chief. And which I think is, you know, most people, because these are the photo moments, they'll see the police chief coming up to city council and giving a report, or, you know, being in the spotlight like that. But day to day, your boss is a city manager. How important do you think that is how important is that relationship?
Oh, it's critical. It's critical to getting anything done through city government. And the really nice thing about the situation we're in now is I've worked with Cheryl Long now for about 3 years, and we've worked on a lot of different projects together. I trust her. She trusts me. We usually have the same end goal in mind from the onset of any project that we're working on. And so the relationship is absolutely critical. But I think because we have worked together for the last 3 years, there won't even be a bump in the road making this transition for the two of us.
I do. I think it's going to be in January. Like a whole, everything's, even though like the council was elected last year, everything is really kind of starting now. Everything, council members were new. They had to get up to speed, but like in January, I feel like all of the pieces will be in place.
I agree. You know, we had a brand new mayor at the time last January, brand new council pretty much. We had an interim city manager. We had an interim police chief. And now, like you said, we have a veteran mayor, veteran city council now. We have a permanent city manager and now a permanent police chief. And now we can all get to work together.
So your appointment is historic in that you are the first woman to serve as the police chief of Cincinnati. What's going through your mind right now about that? Or do you not think about things like that?
Yeah. So, I think everybody has probably heard me tell this story, but I'm going to repeat it anyway. I started the recruit class in October of 1990. And early on during our time in the recruit class, there was a moment where everybody had to kind of talk about, where do you see yourself in your career? And I said, I want to be the first female police chief. And I never looked back from making that statement. I've enjoyed every single minute of being on this job. I've worked to a point to set myself up for success as the police chief. And I, like I said, I wouldn't change a moment. I've experienced pretty much every aspect of this agency. So I know how you make a decision over here, it's going to affect this unit over here. If you make a change here, it's going to have this kind of effect somewhere else. So I can connect all the dots because I've been around a long time and I've had a lot of assignments. That being said, it is not lost on me at all about the fact that I'm the first woman to permanently lead this agency. We have such great people in this agency, sworn in civilian staff, men and women. The work they do every day is beyond remarkable. And so I applaud them for that. What I hope this does do is to show the women in the department and women outside of our department that if you set a goal, work hard to attain it, anything's possible. You can do anything you set out to do. You know, we signed that 30 by 30 initiative in September of 21. And, you know, that's about having 30% women in your sworn ranks by the year 2030. But it's not just about hiring them. It's about retaining them and promoting them. And so what I'd like the women on this department to do is think about what you want to do with your career and then figure out how to get there. And by that, I mean, if we might have a female officer who's thinking, maybe a young, brand new officer, well, I want to be a homicide investigator someday. Okay, how can we get you there? What kind of training do you need? What kind of experiences in the department will help you get there? And because women oftentimes would think, well, I want to be a homicide investigator, but I'll never get there. I'll never get the chance. So I'm not going to do anything to set myself up to get there. And I'm trying to change that perception. You can do anything you want to do. I addressed some of our women's group on this issue. And I am clear, though, that nothing is a gift. They have to work hard and they have to earn it. But I will give them as many opportunities to work hard and to earn things. But nobody's going to be given a gift. Nobody has given me a gift throughout my career. I feel like I've worked very hard for everything I've attained. I've had some wonderful mentors in my career. All of them were men. And I spoke to a couple of them when I found out I was going to be named the chief. And I told them, you saw something in me that I didn't see early in my career. And I wouldn't be sitting here today if it weren't for them.
So first of all, I don't think I've heard that story. And Sherry was writing down furiously when you started talking into her notebook. So I think that might be a new story for Sherry, too.
It is.
That's a good story. So I was going to ask you specifically about mentors, and you mentioned it. Can you name any by name?
Oh, absolutely. The first police chief that I worked for that really took a liking to my career and moved me around and gave me a lot of experiences as Tom Stryker. It got to a point he moved me so many times because his best advice I've ever gotten in my career came from him. He said, do the job nobody else wants. Do it for 2 to 2.5 years. Leave it a better place than you found it and then move on to something else. So if you look at my personnel file, and Cam Knight did. But if you look at my personnel file, it looks like within the department, I can't keep a job very long. But that's because he kept moving me around to give me more and more experiences. So Tom Stryker is a huge part of why I am today, where I am today. Jim Whalen took an interest in me early in my career. Vince DeMasi. And towards the end of his career, Chief Isaac, he gave me tremendous opportunities. So had it not been for those individuals and many more, but those were the four that probably had the greatest impact and helped me get to where I am today. I know those are all names that you guys have probably not heard for a little while, but I'm resurrecting the names.
But at one time in my life, wrote a million times a week. It was a hallmark of Chief Stryker to make sure that anyone who had a goal of being in leadership did all the jobs. I know. He really believed in that and was like, you need to anyone who's coming up and if this is where you want your career to be, then you have to experience everything. And I think that I agree that helped you. I'm sure the city manager was looking at that in that you have done all of the jobs.
Yeah. Chief Stryker and I had kind of a running joke. I kept my boxes in the trunk of my car. I never unpacked them because I never know when he was going to move me again. So it's kind of a running joke between he and I.
So do you have a, like kind of a time frame in mind? You know, you've been an officer, 32 years?
Yeah, I just started my 33rd year in October.
But you're not that old. Do you kind of have a time frame in your head of like, I want to do this job for 10 years, or are you not thinking like that?
I'm not really thinking like that. During the selection process, I did give the city manager a commitment that I would stay for an extended period of time. I know the time and effort that goes into searching and finding a suitable police chief. So I would never do this for a short period of time and then move on. I'm happy. I'm healthy. Things are good, going very well in the department. So as long as those three things can stay on par for me, on course, I'm going to stick around a while.
All right, Chief, thank you. I could ask you a million more questions. Don't worry, I will.
I have one real quick question. Go ahead. And I could probably ask Cam, but I'm curious, with all the different roles you played, were you ever the public information officer?
I was not. I was not the PIO. I did not do PIO. And the other thing I never did in my career, and I have the utmost respect for the officers who do this, is SWAT.
SWAT
was never on my radar, and that it takes a special kind of person to do SWAT activity for sure.
And that person has to do it. It does have to be the right person. You can't force yourself into a role like that if it's not who you are.
Well, I think it also takes a special kind of person to be the PIO because they have to deal with people like Sherry and Cam and
TV news who work, at midnight and 1 a.m.
I have to tell you, Chief, that even though you weren't the PIO, when we have crossed paths, I have been very grateful for your respect of what the media does, what the press does. I found you to be someone as transparent and open as you possibly can. So I'm lobbying you right now to continue that.
Me too.
Absolutely. But you guys have a job to do. I recognize that.
All right. Well, now my question's answered, Sarah. Yeah, now you can wrap it up.
We can wrap this up. I appreciate you coming on today. And
you're very,
very
welcome.
Look forward to seeing all of these things that you're going to do.
Just before we hang up, I do have one shout out.
Do it.
My husband.
Oh.
God love that man. We've been married 42 years, been doing this job for into 33, and he has never hesitated to let me take on a new adventure with the police department. So God love him.
It's important to have a spouse that supports, what you do. I have one of those. I work a lot. And even though he's in the same business as me, he gets it. And he's like, go do what you need to do.
Yeah. It takes a special kind of person to be a spouse of a police officer.
All right. Thanks, Chief.
You're welcome, guys.
Okay.
Have a good day.
I'm very excited to see. I do think that she's not kidding. There's a lot to be done, and I don't think you've been the interim chief. You don't sit around and take assessment of things when you've worked from the day one. I do think that you get to work. So I'm interested to see, watch how that all goes and everything with Cameron Knight. But before I do that, I am going to take just a little bit of time off. It has been a crazy month of news, and so it's the holidays, Burl.
It is the holidays. Are you tired of holiday Christmas music yet? Do you listen to a lot of it?
I do. I actually like it. I try and wait till after Thanksgiving, although Spotify did just tell me that my favorite song of the year is All I Want for Christmas, and I love that song.
Mariah Carey?
Mariah Carey.
It's a solid song.
It is, but it's my favorite. Like, that's the song I listen to the most, but I only listen to it for like a month.
I used to really enjoy that song. Now I can't help but think about how she tried to trademark Queen of Christmas.
That was a bold move
or something
on her.
Like that.
Yeah, it was
yeah.
a bold
and
move.
And so it kind of like took a little of the sheen
off
that song
for me. I know the judge called her
me.
A patent bully.
Yeah.
That you can't.
But it's still a good song.
It's still a good
song.
I
mean, I think it belongs to be on the list of classics. What is that your, so that's your favorite?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
You know what I think mine is? And this is going like, this okay. is like way back, you know, because my parents listened to it and it just reminds me of like being a kid around Christmas times, even though it was an old song then. And that's Andy Williams. It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year.
That's a good song.
You know how that goes?
Nobody wants me to sing, bro.
Oh, man. It starts with the horn section. Ba-da-da-da-da. And he's like, it's the most wonderful time. Everybody's probably sick of that. They don't need to hear me sing either, but that's my favorite.
I don't want to hear you sing it.
No,
you know what this podcast?
It's my Christmas karaoke song,
this
though.
This podcast, since Jason Williams left, is missing singing. And even kind of when I came in, right, Phil? There was a lot more singing before I came, but because I can't sing at all, I feel like I tamped it down, and that's really disappointing because it's a podcast. There should be singing.
We should have a singer be guest at
Phil,
one point.
Phil plays instruments, right? That's correct?
We could do that, yeah. But I tell you, do you have a Christmas song that when it comes on the radio, you just like switch channels? You just can't stand it?
Slow ones. I like the more peppy
you
ones.
You like the peppy ones?
I do. You know what? Alex Coolidge's favorite Christmas, we have a tradition.
Yeah.
When we put up our live tree, which I do have a question about that. When we put up our live tree, we listen to the Charlie Brown Christmas.
Yeah.
He loves it. And
you can't
so that's
go wrong
our
with
tradition.
That. You can't go wrong with that. It's great to have on when you're like hosting people because it's like good piano music and it's everybody knows it.
Yes.
It's so recognizable. But getting back to...
Where did you get your tree? Because I saw it. I have been meaning to ask
all
you
right.
this.
I'll tell you about that.
It was the most
I'll
beautiful
tell you about that,
Christmas tree.
But first, I have to kind of... Let's close the loop here on Christmas songs. I'm going to say for the whole world to hear that if I hear Last Christmas by Wham... And I kind of like Wham, mm-hmm. you know? I like George Michael.
We're of a certain age.
The late George Michael.
How
could
we not?
Right, you know? But I just... Everything is wrong about that song. The keyboards, the horrible...
It's from a certain era.
No,
that's part of its charm.
No. Last Christmas, I think, I'm going to start a petition to have it removed from the rotation of all these. Because now, you know...
I don't think that's going anywhere, but go ahead.
Warm 98 locally does, you know, full-time Christmas after Thanksgiving. If you have Sirius XM, there's like multitudes...
I do think multitudes. This year is the big music change.
I mean, you can do the
me.
Country Christmas channel. You can do the classic one. You can do the pop one. You can do the, like, you know, orchestral one. But, yeah, I have a thing against Last Christmas. I know it's irrational. I know I'm going to get a lot of hate for it. But, you know, I'm about making bold statements on this podcast, not shying away from the truth.
This is hard getting back to the Jason days for sure.
Okay, so the tree.
Yeah, it was so beautiful.
All right. Well, thank you. And it's kind of tall. It's the tallest one we've had because we have this perfect place to put a tall tree. But we got very lucky because when we went out to, what is the place called? It's out in Morrow. It's called Big Tree Plantation or something like that.
You know what? I like a place where your name is like, you know what it is.
Yeah, yeah. It's the Big Tree Plantation. And they have a lot of live trees, but they were really getting low on what was available to be cut. And
because you're behind on everything.
I'm behind on everything. But, you know, we have just like this first weekend, not Thanksgiving weekend, but the first weekend of December
we went out. To be fair, the Inquirer... It's been newsy. There's a lot of stuff going on here. Do you feel like you've been,
been
busy?
A little busy. Yeah, I've been a little busy here. But so we like to do a live tree, and we get there, and the guy was very apologetic. He's like, well, there's not very many left. You know, they had also shipped in trees from, I'm not sure where, maybe Michigan, and they had a barn full of, like, cut trees that they had trucked in. But they have fields and fields of trees, and you can see where they've replanted some. Some that will be ready, like, in, like, 5 years. Some that are, you know, getting closer. But the ones that you could cut this year were pretty much gone, wiped out, except for some tall, skinny ones. And that's exactly what we were looking for. So we got there, and because the field was, like, leveled, you could really see the trees, like, that one. There's, like, four or five that we looked at. And then my son William He does the smell test because he doesn't like trees that don't smell very good.
Well, what's the point of having a live tree if it doesn't make your house
right,
smell lovely?
Right, but I think they all smell the same. He was like, this one has a more orangey smell to it, and this one has a this. And I'm like, just pick one. But we were very lucky. One year we had a tall tree, but it was scrawny. It was like the Charlie Brown Christmas tree. It was basically like a stick. It looked like a bottle brush. And
I don't remember this, but your tree this year was so
beautiful. One of my nieces even made fun of it, and she was like, what's wrong with your tree? And I was like, crushed. Then I laughed a little bit. But this one, tall, skinny, very full. Glad you liked it. But yeah, Big Tree Plantation. They're really nice out there. Free hot chocolate. I know it's
that's fun.
It's pretty late to promote them, but for next year, if you're looking for a place.
We didn't get a live tree this year. We weren't home as much as I thought we were going to be, so I let it go, and I'm sorry that I did.
Well, I'm making up for lost time because we had a live tree when I was growing up until my younger brother, I don't know, when he was around 5 or 6, he started getting allergies really bad. And the pediatrician was like, well, do you have a live tree? And we're like, yes. And he's like, I think he's you know, having some issues because of the live tree. You better switch to an artificial tree. And so my parents, you know, switched to an artificial tree because my brother, you know,
I would make the coolest boys suffer through it.
And so, yeah. So
that reminds me, I have some tree-related news.
Yeah.
This is apparently we're having a holiday segment. That's all. It's not that so Cincinnati.
Well, we are heading into the last week of the year, and we're going to take a week off. This will be our last podcast of 2022, Sherry.
It's flown by.
It has flown by. But you have tree news?
We're a good dynamic, too. I have tree news. So it turns out that the fountain we had Christy Simon on as a guest, and I just saw her a couple days ago,
And remind people who that is.
She is the events coordinator for 3CDC. She has the best job
in the world. We don't care what her official title is. She's the one who's in charge.
The Christmas tree picker.
Of picking the Christmas tree for Fountain Square. Yes.
Okay. So she did not go with the tree this year. I think I've convinced her to go in future years because I think it sounds like the most fun thing ever. And so anyway, so she, you know, gets the details from her team. She did see the pictures and everything. It is a beautiful tree. Like, right from the get-go, we saw it going up. It was no Charlie Brown Christmas tree.
Right.
And she said on this podcast that the tree was from Medina because that is what she had been told by her team. But it turns out the tree is actually from Worcester. Now,
wait,
I'm kind of
did you
like,
say Worcester?
Worcester.
You mean Worcester?
Worcester. That is it. Okay. Worcester?
Tomato, tomato.
Okay, not to them. And also, they care that, because now the story was picked up in other newspapers around the state.
Oh, no. So we have our first bona fide.
So people saw it.
Wait a minute. We have our first bona fide That's a Cincinnati podcast correction.
So basically, it does turn out that those two cities are very protective of their cities and everything.
Yeah,
and I know, and they very much care about it. But it turns out, let me pronounce it right. The tree is from
Worcester.
Worcester.
Right.
So anyway, but yes, so it happens sometimes. I don't think she wasn't expecting. It's not like she was sitting down and expecting me to ask 100 questions about the tree, which is where we went with that.
You know, true story, when I was working at a different newspaper out of town, there was a guy working there. His nickname was Worcester. They actually said Worcester. And I said, why do they call you Worcester? And he's like, oh, that's where I'm from, but it's pronounced Worcester. And I was like, well, that's interesting. That's very interesting. So I've always had that in my head.
So, okay.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Ohio towns like that.
There are.
That you think it's one way and it's really another.
There definitely are. Cincinnati.
Not that.
Cincinnati. Oh, yeah.
I'm against that.
And speaking of our new police chief, I don't know if she said this while we were recording or right beforehand, you can tell someone who's grown up here, especially on the West Side, because of how they pronounce the name of our NFL football team.
Oh.
She said Bengals.
Okay, this is true. Yeah.
It's subtle. It's not like Bengals, but just instead of Bengals, it's Bengals.
That was before, just between us.
Bengals, yeah.
When we were saying hello.
Exactly. So anyway, well, happy holidays.
Yeah, happy holidays. All right.
And we'll see everybody next year?
Next year with planned out guests. Not that I don't love all of you when you get a call from me on Wednesday mornings. So don't forget, you know what, you guys, tweet at me, Sharon at Coolidge. Tweet, you know, suggestions for podcast guests. I'm always happy to hear from you.